Hello, this is the Tori Eternity Delphi Council Debriefings, where the storm has a name. We are your hosts, Lehman and Jay, and today we will continue talking about the Beta Clearance GM Primer. But before we get into that, we have an email from T. So we do encourage you to email us at torgdcd@gmail.com. You can send us your emails. We will answer any questions you have to the best of our ability, as well as if you comment, we'll comment back. So this is a pretty short email, but it states, "Hi guys, haven't mailed in a while, but still avidly listening and very much enjoying the podcast. Currently playing through the God Box, and I will say spoilers, so you might just skip ahead if you don't want to know about the adventure of the God Box. It says, and looking at the map of Meritika, the Abominary Temple in the north, I can't seem to find any info on what it is or who or what the Abominari are. As ever, any help greatly appreciated, T." So T, thank you for the email. And what he's talking about is in the God Box, when you get to the nice color map that they have on page 32 of Meritika, up at the northwest is the Abominary Temple. And I will say, when I did this, I saw the Ohibi Temple, which is where you're supposed to go, and I guess I just saw temple and temple, and that's where I had my player characters go to finish the act, because Ohibi is a village. But you're right, in the God Box, there is no description of that, and one of the reasons is this map is a color reproduction of the map in classic Torgs, The Land Below. So The Land Below has a chapter of for Meritika in it. It's about 33, 34 pages. And there they actually briefly describe the Abominari Temple. And if you wish to go like on DriveThruRPG and purchase the PDF or find the book secondhand, you're welcome to do that. But since it's an extremely short entry, I figured I would just read it to let you know the information. So, the Abominari Temple is in the northwestern portion of Meritika and presents some interesting questions regarding Meritika. It's hidden deep in the uninhabited jungles of the north and only a few kilometers from Meritika's wall. It is obviously the product of the Law of Wonders, with a trio of floating obelisks which revolve around a central point once every 16 Earth hours. The obelisks float about 2 meters off the ground and are made of a shiny black and very hard stone. They give toughness, but it's classic Torque toughness, which would be different. They are about 4 meters high and are covered with carved runes. Apparently, growing out of the bottom of each obelisk are several long roots at the base of the obelisk. They seem almost to be made of stone, but the ends are flexible and definitely plant-like. And then it talks about a creature living nearby. So that is pretty much all that is known about the Abominari Temple. But as I said, the Land Below Classic Torg book does get into various other places of Meritika that if you wanted to use that as a supplement to your God Box, I would say that that would be a perfectly fine thing to do. Jay, did you have any other ideas on the Abominari or anything?
I never ran God Box, so this was kind of my first time really countering it, and then looking into it, it seems that this has been a question people have had for a long time.
Oh,
What is
okay.
the Abominary Temple? Because it doesn't explain anything in the actual Land Below book, and it wasn't in any Infiniverse update except for as part of a quiz. It's interesting because there is this creature that kind of patrols around there, but it literally is just described as a 3 meter tall, large wings, sharp teeth. That's it. Like it's just a, so it's not really explained at all. So the thing is, a lot of games will include things like these, which are just there to pique a GM's interest, and maybe the game master will expand on it. The one thing though, with the old way that the Infiniverse exchange and everything worked, like the Infiniverse updates and the dispatches and everything, is you never knew when something was going to be like an official adventure. So as a GM, you're kind of like, do I want to mess with this and then find out 3 months from now that they're sending out an actual adventure about it? But now in, Torg Eternity, with the whole like everyone's cosm versus their own, it's less of an issue. But it's a neat thing, just Law of Wonders, and probably would actually be more interesting in Torg Eternity, given, what's going on with all the wonders. It's a bit different than it was in classic Torg. Like they weren't necessarily being saved pocket dimension things, so this could lead to anywhere. Who knows?
I think that's, even though short is a interesting description that a game master could flesh out and turn into an act or even a full adventure, depending.
Yep.
As a complete sort of, I won't say off topic because it is the same topic of Maritica. One of the things I would like to do at some point in the future would be to come out with some type of source book for Maritica as its own thing, similar to how the Land Below was. I think it's a really cool wonder. It's a huge wonder in itself, and fleshing it out more than either the God Box or the old Land Below, which also talked about other areas of the Land Below, and just focusing on Maritica would be kind of cool. And then maybe the Abominari Temple might get more defined or not, depending. So
Leave it as a mystery.
don't hold your breath, please, because
There's a lot to go through first.
yes, we have a lot of things and projects before that, but that would be like a pet project of mine that I would like to do, because I in classic Torg, I greatly preferred Land Below over Living Land, and that was one thing that I was happy with Torg Eternity, was the Living Land kind of took a lot of the cool things from Land Below and made itself cool because of it, and even, as you said, made it even better. So thank you, T, for the email, and we will move into part two for the beta clearance GM primer. And we're going through, we were talking about encounter boosting previously, but now we're just getting into general advice. So one of the things on general advice kind of shocked me when I reread this, because I went through both the GM primer and the player primer when they first came out, which was around Living Land time. And then really didn't look at it other than like perks and things like the extra requisition stuff. Didn't really read a lot of it. But now, having played the game for a very, very long time, and knowing the rules and being a line developer, I get to this disconnection part. And it says, a disconnected Storm Knight is extremely vulnerable. Go ahead and exploit that weakness, especially if the players are complaining that things are too easy. Long burst or all-out attack, and let the bonus dice determine the unfortunate hero's fate. It does give a little thing of, conversely, if the players are new or having a tough time, look for excuses to prioritize a connected Storm Knight or prompt the team to make choices to protect their vulnerable member. So, Jay, what are your thoughts on this? Hey, if a guy's disconnected, focus fire, spend some possibilities, do some
Yeah, I
all-out
mean,
attacks.
sounds like a good idea. So you got to remember, I come from playing a lot of Cyberpunk and Hackmaster, so hitting a character while they're down is not against my wheelhouse. I would normally do that. So in Hackmaster, they would even say, like, in D&D, if a monster hits you and you're in the negatives and you're bleeding out and everything, they usually go and they move on to someone else, and that lets someone come by and stabilize or heal you. But in Hackmaster, like, no, just they keep until you're dead, right? So, and that could kind of shock people. So this is a much less hardcore version of that, because the thing is, as it mentions, the assumption here is that they're having an easy time of it, and that is, we've discussed this a lot in the past. It's a very player friendly game. It's very hard to actually get defeated, let alone killed. So it's kind of like you might as well as go for it. And the thing is, players will always, nothing puts the fear in players like not having possibilities to spend. So as soon as they're disconnected, their like bravado really changes. But realistically, depending on when it happens, they might still have a bunch of cards available, and other players might still have a lot of other abilities and things, and the odds of them like just outright getting killed are pretty low, though not impossible. And then depending on what reality you're in, you might have an up on defeat test, or you might have Cosm cards that let you come back anyway. So it's not that big a deal. So it could be a very dramatic thing to suddenly hit them, but it does take a little bit of knowledge. Like, okay, if you know they're very vulnerable and only have one wound, and they look like they're about to cry, you don't hit them. But so it's also knowing your players. But some players love a challenge, some players definitely do not love a challenge. So you just gotta know your group. But yeah, the funny thing is, when I read that, I was like, yep.
What made me like, I don't want to say second guess, but what like stuck with me is, and I've talked about it before, is some, not all, some of my players love the martyr card because they like making new characters, and they would be ones that even in a game that doesn't come back, at your group XP, they would still just make characters on the side because they just like, they're altaholics, as we call them. But other than that, the main reasons and the main times that I can remember a character dying, as we talked about in our character death episode, is disconnection. And like the guy had already got wounded, and I didn't realize that. And then all of a sudden, yeah, let's focus fire. Oops. Okay, you're in Aurorish. Now you're a ghost of your previous character, or something like that, or
You can
vampire
always
or
just offer them
something.
doomed, right?
Yeah, doomed. So I absolutely agree with Jay. Know your group. Know your players. That's one of the main keys to knowing if attacking those player characters when they're disconnected, what type of reaction. So going along with that, we'll move to the next thing, which I can already kind of see where you might be going, is with targeting. Which it states it's a golden rule for targeting with opponents is spread the love. So in a lot of games, game masters, to either be fair or not seem like they're picking on a certain player character, they are going to quote unquote spread the love, meaning they're going to attack everybody equally. If there's five bad guys and five storm knights, they're going to each bad guy is going to attack one storm knight, or if there's more, then they might attack the tank who's meant for it. But here, where there's the thing that if anyone actively in the fray should have something target them each round, it's talking about that. So let's go back to that disconnection one. What are your thoughts on focus fire? Because the players, they always do it. They ignore the minions to hit the big bad guy. They focus fire on anybody that they might see as being a heavy damage dealer, whether that's a magic user or somebody who can buff or heal, you know, the healers. And this is in a lot of games where the players will absolutely focus fire,
Oh, yeah.
because if they can get one guy down, then that's one less person fighting them, and then they switch to the next person and the next person and the next person. So what are your thoughts in Torg Eternity specifically about targeting? Focus fire, spread the love, try to play it depending on
It
the
depends,
villains.
like, yeah, it depends on the threats. Like, if it's just a bunch of shock troopers, probably spread it. But here's the thing about spread the love. The math makes that a poor choice. Because you get your combined action bonus, but then if you're splitting your fire between multiple characters, the multi-target penalty is way higher than the combined action bonus. So even if you have 10 shock troopers splitting up between four PCs, like they're gonna be at a negative. And if these are ords, they're not getting any card bonuses. They're not getting any possibilities unless you've got GM possibilities. So 9 times out of 10, if you have a big group of regular goobers splitting fire, it just does nothing. Or maybe hits that scholar that is like crawling around the adventure with a strength and dexterity of 5, right? And it just tends to do almost nothing. On the flip side of that, it's considerably faster than rolling individually. And I think you just kind of know when to do one and when to do another, because I played in a game with Greg Gordon, and he was rolling for individual, like Adino's warriors attacking. And when someone asked him about that, he's like, "Look, you have to know sometimes you have to make it dangerous. This is how you make it dangerous." So I guess just know when to do it is the big thing. And as far as focus fire, it's funny because it doesn't come up too much, but because of a lot of enemies are melee, but I do definitely focus fire when there's ranged enemies, I think. But a lot of encounters aren't really set up in the way that villains can necessarily focus fire as effectively as players. And then you get into this sort of meta game thing where, as a GM, okay, for this round, we're going to focus fire on the tank just so the tank can feel all fancy. And then you guys can see the number that hits them. And then maybe the next turn I'll change the fo or at least threaten to change the focus fire, and that way they'll really be maneuvering around and doing a lot of interaction attacks to avoid getting that like 24 damage hit on somebody other than the tank. So it depends on how you use it. You can kind of use that to like sculpt the battle in some ways. It kind of like, just playing with your players' minds in some ways like that. But yeah, it's just sometimes you do one, sometimes you do the other. Just be aware that's like spreading the love is effectively saying I'm probably doing nothing or 1 to 2 shock.
Yeah, I agree. And you did bring up a good point. If you use combined actions, it's a simple way of rolling once and determining a bonus for both, or to hit. And then if you do better hitting, then you get more bonus dice on your damage. But as you said, Greg Gordon showed, you know, if you separate and you have each of those minions fire, there's more chances that one of them is going to explode, or a couple of them are going to explode and do some damage that either gets through or gets soaked, but then the player needs to spend some resources to prevent getting hurt. So that's a couple of ways, game masters. If it's going too easy, you might want to separate your minions. If it's becoming too difficult, you might combine them as the combined action. The focus fire on a specific Storm Knight, I have two ways of thinking about that. First, how intelligent are the villains? If they're just creatures, they're going to attack whatever's closest to them. The other thing, think about your Storm Knight group is a number of people that are all equivalent, at least in XP, mostly. So in the way official Torg is, if one person has 50 XP, the whole group has 50 XP. So you're all able to kind of do, while not exactly the same thing, you're on par with each other. Where the enemies, you might have a main bad guy, maybe a lieutenant who's maybe has a wound or two wounds instead of the full three, and then you're going to have lots of minions. And so it's not exactly the same when 10 minions, a lieutenant, focus fire on one person, and the entire party of five to whatever Storm Knights is focused on the main bad guy. So that's one thing to think about. Use that, what we talked about last time in the Game Master Primer, the rule for the dramatic scene setback when you drop a team of Stormers on, and then you might be able to pull that off. And those Stormers would know they're sent to specifically to destroy this Storm Knight group. So just as Storm Knights get briefed before a meeting on what they are,
Yeah, they know what
think
they're
of
doing.
those Stormers having been briefed on, okay, this guy's a big tank, so take him out last because he's going to be hard. Aim for this squishy guy and this, healer, and this guy loves to buff, so get rid of those, people first. Hold this guy down with some, fire because he's ranged, or and kind of think about that. The other kind of general in all games I have is what I call the Molotov cocktail rule, which came out in a I first learned about it. I'm not saying it was invented there, but it was basically in a fantasy game where somebody was wanting to make the put the rag in the whiskey bottle and light it on fire and make a grenade, and the game master was like, he kind of paused the game and he says, "What you're saying is okay. It's just once that's done, it's going to be known. And then, do you wish this to happen to you? If you're fine with that, then go ahead and throw that whiskey bottle with the flaming, wick in it. If you don't want that to happen, then don't do it." And that just became what we call the Molotov cocktail rule, was if the players come up with something cool and they want to do it, let them do it. Just they
But it's
need
on
to
the table
know
now.
that it's something that, is going to get out there, whether by word of mouth or looking at the evidence of, what had happened, etc., that's going to be figured out and then done to the player characters at some point. So
There's also a thing in the targeting section where it mentions something that is extremely basic Torg Combat 101, but it's probably worth mentioning, is that even if you are doing combined actions, you still sometimes might want to break things up so you can have one group do an interaction attack and then have a separate group attack after you've made whoever you're going to target vulnerable, because you can't do both. I mean, you can do both at the same time, but it won't apply the vulnerable until after the whole action is done. So you wouldn't get the bonus from it right away.
So, and I've seen game masters do that where they'll have a couple of groups. The first one does their action to get those vulnerables, and then the second group comes in and does their action and gets the benefit of those vulnerables. So that's something that players do all the time, and the villains should be able to do as well. Then let's get into mobs. So just have you used mobs the way that they're written, or not, or do you tend to just do the combined action part of it and have people, especially when mobs are being targeted, do you have them target individuals within a mob or the mob themselves?
Yeah, so here's the funny thing about that. Like, the first time I saw mobs was in D&D 4th edition, I think. And then they would have specific creatures that were listed as being mobs. So that was a and so when Torg added mobs, I'm like, okay, and I just kept waiting to see some creatures that had mob as a rule, but nothing ever did. So I never realized it was like a different it's still the same threats. You're just supposed to use a mob rule when it's convenient. So I kind of used a weird hybrid, I guess, because I pretty much always used the fatigue and shock adding up. So basically, if the player I would if the player shot at a mob, they wouldn't be shooting at all of them. They would still have to multi-target how many of them they wanted to hit. And then if they did, like, say there was like five of them, and they hit and did two shock, then that would essentially be 10 shock. So if they only had six shock, then that would just get rid of one of them instead of putting two shock on each of them. But if they did one wound, two shock, that would do one wound to each of them. So if they were dashes, it would just kill them all, right? Which is essentially what the mob rule is, but they would still the multi-targeting like they would still have to do it. I think that actually is what the rule is. I've always been kind of confused looking at it, to be honest, but that's sort of how I always ran it. But it wasn't a single contained mob. It was a more fluid kind of thing. So once the player decided who they're shooting at, that became the mob, right? And then likewise, if a bunch of shock troopers decided to shoot at this guy, they were now a mob. But if these shock troopers over here were doing an interaction attack, they were a different mob. It wasn't just one mob of shock troopers. I don't know how that flies in the official rules, but that's how I've always run it.
Yeah, I will say when I first read the mobs rule, it completely confused me. I actually had to like have little tokens and put them in on the table and kind of go step by step how it works. And that just made me do a hybrid as well, where I usually most of the time, not always, would use the combined actions. Okay, these five mobs are together. They, as a group, are going to shoot at this opponent, and these other five. And usually I do it as a, in the adventures, a lot of times it's like X many minion or X many thing per Storm Knight. So I would combine those and, okay, this is a mob. And then give them the combined action. They would do the same thing. And then the next group, they might attack or interact against the same opponent, but they were kind of their separate thing. But I never really did the shock stacking up or things. I just kind of went, okay, if you still need to target individual people and have
The
them
shock stacking was really more just for not having to record it
right
on a whole bunch of
bunch of
different
different
enemies
enemies.
all at once on roll 20. Like, okay, add two, add two, add two.
And that was a way that I kind of did it, as a sneak, not sneak peek. I will say we've tweaked the mobs. I think they work a lot better in the in what will be the year two rules. It's not very different, but it's just a little more because the big problem I saw is both a player and a game master, because even when I'm playing, I can see kind of like, oh, that's really kind of not good for the game master. And it would be when you are getting attacked by the bad guy, the main bad guy, whether it's for the act or the entire, you know, seven act adventure, whoever the main bad person is, everybody ignores the mobs. It's just they're cleanup. And a couple of thoughts I had were mobs should be easy to get rid of. Mobs should, in my opinion, as we're looking at cinematic logic, they should be like all the little nameless people in John Wick that he just goes through and pops, and you just pop, 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 and he just goes through them. They're nameless, but they do shoot him and they hurt him. So they should be easy to take out, but they shouldn't be ignored, because if you ignore them, they're gonna hit you, and it shouldn't just be that 1 out of 10 that exploded. So that was something that we've tinkered with, and I think I've been a lot more satisfied with what will be the new mob rules, but it's because of having 8 years of seeing how these mobs work and stuff that.
How the whole spread the love equates to almost
Right.
nothing most of the time.
Exactly. So with all of that, that is a goal that we had for mobs, and I'm very excited for putting that together, and hopefully you'll all get to see that soon. Then let's move to statistics on the fly, which I think is a really handy chart. Game Masters.
Is where it hides where speed comes from.
Yes.
Yeah.
Game Masters, download this PDF. It's a pay what you want, so if you don't want to pay anything, you put a zero there, and you'll want to print out page 7 for reference. And then you might print out the previous and following pages just to get the whole shebang in a nice quick reference, especially if you don't have a PDF reader at your table. But it's basically, as you said, this is where speed, they finally, clearly define that speed is not your dex value. It is your dex value looked at on the value chart, and then you take that attribute, you find the you times it by 3, you look at
Or attribute.
the number, or sorry, you add 3, and then you turn it into a value, and that's what you get. And it says if you happen to have four kilometers
Kilometers.
kilometers per hour, then you add 2 instead of 3. But that's basically how you get how they get the values for all the cars and vehicles and things like
Yeah, because
that.
that's been a long-standing item of confusion for new game masters, I think.
Right. So it's just that. And then they have a very nice, there's a very nice comparative toughness and damage chart. One side is example toughnesses, which go all about a human non-combatant toughness and armor, human combatant, church police, and then you start getting into Humvees and Mack trucks and bulldozers and different types of tanks. And modern warships, if you'd ever
Yeah.
want to try to fight against a warship. So all those have toughnesses
So a
and
warship
armor.
could ram a Boraka.
Yeah. And do something. And then there is just basic damage. So everything from like bare hands in a basic person's hands is damage 7. A long sword is average damage 10. They have pistols and bazookas, landmines, all types of different cannons, and both ancient and like modern auto cannons. So it's a very nice, handy chart when you're throwing something up against some Storm Knights, or the Storm Knights decide to do something that you haven't planned on, because that happens very often. Like
Right.
you're trying to run them off, and you're like, okay, there's a tank pointed, there it's cannon at you, and the Storm Knights are, we charge it, and you're like, oh crap, I was expecting them to run. Well, you can pull up this, and you can get your tank toughness and figure out what type of cannon it has on it, and use that as well, and then you have a quick and easy way to do that. So what are your thoughts on the comparative toughness and damage chart?
Yeah, I think it's pretty useful, although I think when you start hitting the top end, it kind of turns abstract and is kind of less useful. Because I would have to Google, like, what is a 152 millimeter cannon versus a 203 millimeter cannon? Like, what's the difference? I don't know. But the difference between, like, a 45 automatic and a bazooka is pretty obvious. So, it's also useful for when you're the tank character comes up to you. The player gives you the sheet, and you're like, okay, toughness 23, huh? What do I realistically need to do damage to this person? Oh, a 25-millimeter cannon. Okay.
Right.
Or, anyway, a cannon of some kind, I guess. So that kind of like gets you in the mindset of what it actually takes, and vice versa. If you're going to be throwing a techno demon at them, what would it take the players having to potentially damage it? Although, because they tend to get good slash outstanding successes, they do more damage, so it's less of an issue there.
Yeah, I think the chart's really nice. They kind of get into some maneuver ratings, and like they even give you sample wounds. Like wounds are usually based on an object's overall mass, so they have one wounds for motorcycles to small cars, two wounds for most four-seaters, three wounds for vehicles around 10 to 25 meters long, four for objects 25 to 50 meters long, and five or more for vehicles that are even bigger. Hardened military designs may be granted an extra wound. So if you have something that's smaller but armored, then you would add a wound for that extra hardened military design. So I think that's a nice little piece of advice and a handy thing to be able to use.
Plus, where they say, even with this big old chart, 15 to 17 damage is probably what you should be looking at for a powerful attack.
Right.
Don't go crazy.
Like in a when cosmos collide.
Right.
There are a couple of adventures that get into very crazy toughnesses and damage outputs, but in those cases, it's designed that way. This is just kind of warning or advising the game master for the most part, because you usually wouldn't want some random encounter that just got started on a whim to
That
be the
just smoke
thing
everyone. Yeah.
that ends up TPKing the group instead of adding to the adventure. So the next thing I also find very helpful, because it's a question that gets asked a lot, which are skill ratings, which they say here are some few useful ranges for skill values. So then they break it down: beta, gamma, delta, and omega, and then they give skill ratings on like a simple word to describe
Yep.
what a skill total might be. So on beta, they say most skills are between 16, which would be considered weak beta, and 24 strong. We're talking about threats in this case, not necessarily storm knights. These may have significant weakness in one of the interaction attacks. So a lot of times you would even notice in a threat stat block is most of the time they might have a couple of really good ones, but they usually have one low one, so that if somebody on the Storm Knight team, you almost want a Storm
Someone
Knight,
can do
someone
it.
should be able to do it. And that's something I've noticed on my groups. They'll pick whatever type of character they want, but then they're like, okay, who can do the maneuver against them? Who can do the trick against them? Who can, do the intimidation against them? So they have all of those fields covered, so when a weakness pops up, they at least have somebody that can potentially exploit that. And then they say these are the beta with these numbers are experienced stormers named Ravagons and late planting Gospog. I would almost say after all the Gospog have came out, maybe even middle planting, because some of the late planting have possibilities and are very tough. And then in gamma, those would be the lesson skills would be a 19, and the strong skills at 26. So a couple of 3 points added to the weak side, 2 point added to the strong side. They suggest special abilities that mitigate Storm Knight's advantages. Major demons, gargantuan monsters, and villains who have a shot at becoming a High Lord fit well here. So things like Thrakmos and the
Right.
Living Land, that's what.
Named characters.
Right. The named bad guys other than the High Lords, like your Wuhan, your Thrakmos, etc. So do you have any. I don't really have any like go-to beyond Like, if I have a melee villain, he's going to get Whirlwind and probably Relentless and things like that. Do you have any specific anti-Storm Knight special abilities that you like slipping onto
Not really, to be honest.
threats?
I don't really like giving Relentless because I always forget to spend shock, so not in particular, to be honest.
Oh, that's fine.
I usually just use whatever they normally have. I'm just trying to think if there's ever been one that had anything crazy. Usually I'll just buff their interaction attacks, to be honest. Or give them minions.
Jezreel has that one
That crazy one,
that k
yeah.
crazy where I can act. I always act before and after the Storm Knights every
Okay.
round, you, no matter what the drama card says. That's
I mean, that opens it up to know that you can. I mean, I guess I've designed characters that had special powers, like in Caldera, the main villain had a bunch of things that were tied to, depending on what the drama card revealed, so stuff like that. But I tend to find, and this has happened with other characters even in that same adventure, I have found that the more weird abilities you give them, the more you just forget to use them during the fight. So I
Right.
tend to keep them relatively straightforward, and just having a higher number often does enough. To me, this was one of the most handy parts of this entire beta clearance GM's primer. This is the chart and I guess rating that I have looked at the most,
Right.
I think, out of this entire book.
Yeah, and then they go on for Delta and Omega, which are basically you bump it even higher.
Theoreticals.
Right. And then like Delta skills
Although the
22 to
Darkness Device
28.
40 does come up occasionally in some adventures.
And then they just say Delta is where most High Lords and legendary creatures like the Carradine fit. Truly outrageous special abilities. If they're in print there, you can see those outrageous abilities like on the Gaunt Man stat block,
Yeah.
etc. Omega is the 25 through 40, and it says this is for darkness devices themselves, beware. But as you were talking about, the next chart is extremely useful, which is rough, competence level, and then what the skill total is. So what your attribute plus your adds, that's your skill total. If you want a poor skill total, give them a 6. If you want a competent, that's an 8. That's going to be your shock troopers and your base, Edenos, your church police, whatever fills that lurks, fills that role are going to be 8s. You want them a little skilled, you'll bump them up to a 10. Elites are at 12. A renowned master at 14. Top tier 16. World champion 18. And supernaturally gifted 20. So I think that's a very handy chart.
Yeah, and I think this is one of the key things, and this is done in a lot of other games too, especially Cyberpunk. But there's you do not need to make threats as characters.
Right.
They don't need to be put together by any kind of, mechanical, oh, this many points to do this, spending XP, that's kind of a waste on threats. All you need is their toughness, how much damage they do, and you get that from the comparative toughness and damage chart. And then you need their skill ratings. That's really all you need. So you could just, with three numbers, have a monster and go for it. Now, sure, you lose a little bit of granularity for things like strength bonus to damage and stuff like that. But, you could just say, okay, no, they're probably strong, so another plus one damage, something
Right.
like that, right? So if you need to do stuff on the fly, using these two little charts can basically just instantly populate a threat for you.
And I completely agree. I know there's the two philosophies out there of symmetrical PCs
I've
and
long since gone
NPCs,
away from that.
and then the asymmetrical. And my thinking is always, the players are there for the long run, and your threats are there for a few rounds. So you Exactly. You think about a threat, and you go, okay, they're going up against the Storm Knights who have these. I want it to be skilled. Or I want this guy to be an elite. And then now you have a number to go with. You grab a toughness. You grab some damage. You throw some wounds on. And you're pretty much ready to go. If players need to just, you know, if you don't have a mind and they're mind controlling you, well, then you just kind of think and you look at the skill ratings. Okay, what would their willpower be? You know, is this a person who's I buffed up to be a big tank guy that I don't think is very smart or willful? Okay, I'll give him a poor mind or at least competent because he's survived some
I mean, an
stuff.
8 to 10 is usually a fair
Right, so
fair pick.
it's not something that I think anybody, any game master should stress about, because we all, every once in a while, we'll make a mistake. We'll make something a little too easy or a little too hard, or way easier, way hard. But as you play, you'll kind of get where these numbers are, and you'll have seen so many threats in the threat blocks that all kind of have the same main attribute number.
I've been running a side D&D 3.5 game for some of my friends that forced me to do it, and to populate the sheets on Roll20, you pretty much have to like enter in the full stats of the monster. And if you recall, third edition D&D was very much like, okay, it's got to be built exactly like a PC, and you have to go from the ground up, and there was a lot of like minutia. And in high school and university, this was great for me. Like, I loved it. But now I don't got time for that. And the thing to remember is that threats are not characters. They are bundles of difficulty numbers for the characters. So they don't need to be made in such an exacting way, because I'll spend 10 minutes entering the data, just copying it from an adventure, not even making it up myself. 10 minutes, then double checking, make sure it all works, and then the monster just gets killed in one round anyway. And I was like, what a waste of time. Now, granted, I eventually stopped even just entering them into the system and would just roll the dice like normal, and it was much quicker. But it just goes to show I was basically doing that same thing, not treating it like a character, just treating it like it's two hit bonus, it's damage, and it's saving throws and hit points, and that's it. So once you do that, life becomes a lot easier.
Right, and you can describe it however you want. And I'm a big proponent also for reskinning, where you take a stat block and you just change the fluff of what it looks like and what it does. But if that stat block looks good, I'm going to use it.
Yeah, this may have been a wolf, but now it's a tiger, you know, like that kind of thing.
So, having gone through that, there is kind of a last section that we won't go over, but we'll tell you why we won't go over it, is the Year One overview, which goes through Core Earth, Isle, Cyber Papacy, Nile, Empire, Aurorsh, and Pan Pacifica, and Tharkold, which is because, and you'll notice Living Land was left out, because this came along when people were wanting to know what was going on in the rest of the world, because when the core rules came out, it was 90 days, and Living Land came out, it was a year, and then people were like, what's going on in the rest of the world for a year? And we have beta characters, so that's why these beta clearance primers came out. So for this was just a, hey, game masters, here's what we're thinking about doing, and use this until the various source books come out, and some of them are relatively the same, but if you look at some of these, they've been very different, and ended up somewhat different. So it's just kind of certain ones work, certain ones got changed along the way, so it's all pretty much has been superseded by the actual source books themselves.
But in the early time, there's a lot of people clamoring for what's going on in Oror. Who
Right,
knows? You'll have to wait until the last at that time, the last book to come out. It's like, oh.
So, Hopefully you got some good information to think about as a game master for your how to work with beta clearance and above Storm Knights and in general some
To be honest, this
tips and
is not really
stuff.
beta specific info. This is all just good in general.
Yes. There's a few things like if it's beta, it's within this range, but otherwise a lot of it is just good info or the specific things like the Game Master possibilities and the gamma dropping stormers on the party. But otherwise, yeah, a lot of this is just kind of good general advice for game mastering. Again, go to DriveThruRPG. You can look for the beta clearance GM primer and the beta clearance player primer, and download that to get yourself some stuff that you might not see in other places. Having said that, we do thank you for listening. You can email us at torgdcd@gmail.com. We'll answer any questions you have to the best of our ability. We'll comment on your comment. But until next time, we hope you have fun in your own Cosmverse. Bye.